Hello and welcome to Who Goes There, the quiz which lifts the lid on famous people from history. From Adam and Eve to Tony and Cherie, if they're good, bad or ugly enough for the history books, then they qualify for this show. Let's meet the teams. Joining team captain Francis Wheen this week is columnist for The Independent, wit and general all-round good egg, Miles Kington. And facing them, fresh from London's traffic, is team captain Fred Housego, who this week is joined by The Guardian journalist and broadcaster, Polly Toynbee. Now, just a quick note about the scores, because they're overachievers, every one. In general, there will be 2 points for a correct answer, one for anything I have to help you with, and bonus points at my discretion for any truly brilliant insights. If you're all happy with that, let's get on with the show. If you're not, too bad. Let's get on with the show. We begin with an archive round in which each of our panelists will hear a recording of a famous person from history. Their task is simply to tell me in each case whose voice it is and anything else of interest they might be able to deduce from the clip. Francis, have a listen to this.
I am saying that I decided that I would continue to participate in preparing a version of the chronology, not necessarily what would be the final historical internal version, but a version of the chronology that was inaccurate. I did participate in that activity, wittingly and knowingly.
Versions of chronologies? Well, very suspicious. But who was it?
Gosh. Well, it's obviously some American ne'er-do-well, but that doesn't narrow the field much. You know, it could be Colonel Oliver North, could be John Dean, who covered up for Richard Nixon. By pure guesswork, I'll say it's Colonel Oliver North.
Yes, very good. That was the voice of Colonel Oliver North, a man who became a patriotic hero by doing all sorts of things behind the president's back. Miles, your turn for a clip.
At this time, I think it's extra special, and it probably means so much more to me now than it might have done 40 years ago. So, boys, thank you very much for your thoughts always, and my thoughts are always with you. And I shall wear it with great pride. Thank you.
Miles.
It's not Vera Lynn, is it?
It blooming well is.
My God.
Very good. Well done. That was Dame Vera Lynn speaking on receiving her Burma Star in 1985, 41 years after first going to Burma to entertain the troops in her capacity as Forces Sweetheart.
I have a story about her. When I was with Instant Sunshine, we were doing Stop the Year 1 year with Robert Robinson. She was on the show, and the producer said, "Does anyone here know how to play We'll Meet Again?" And I said, "Well, I could learn it on the piano," and I did. I got the sheet music. It's in G. And I learned it. And just for the show, her husband, stroke manager, said to me, what key are you playing? And I said, "Gee, she hasn't sung it in G for 40 years, mate. She's down to E-flat now."
What, flat being the operative word?
And I made a terrible hash of it in E-flat. And she never thanked me.
Polly, what do you make of this?
English words are full of echoes, memories, associations, naturally. They've been out and about, on people's lips, in their houses, in the streets, in the fields, for so many centuries. And that is one of the chief difficulties in writing in today. They're stored with other meanings, with other memories, and they have contracted so many famous marriages in the past.
Wonderful voice. So who was talking about words?
It wasn't Dr. Johnson, was it?
It certainly wasn't. I'm very stuck here. I'm trying to think and listen to the crackle and trying to date the crackle.
You'd be right to date it 30 or 40 years ago, yes.
It's not Edith Sitwell, is it?
No, but no, you're
no,
in the
her
right
voice
neck
was
of
much
that's right, it's weird,
might
wasn't
it be
it?
Virginia Woolf?
Correct.
Ah.
Well done, that was the voice of Virginia Woolf, not only one of the greatest British novelists of the century, but also one of the most precocious. In 1891, she started her own weekly publication entitled The Hyde Park Gate News, which contained her first fictional writings. It was keenly read by adults, even though its author was only 9 years old at the time.
She also dressed up as the Emperor of Abyssinia at one point, do you remember?
Well, don't we all?
Yeah. She got a friend to send a message down to HMS Dreadnought in Portsmouth or wherever it was,
saying the King of Abyssinia is arriving. Would you please give him a state welcome? And she and I think Duncan Grant and various other members of the Bloomsbury group toddle off in their tablecloths and things all wrapped up. And the person who was going to play the Emperor of Abyssinia ducked out at the last minute, so poor old Virginia Woolf was forced to put on false moustache and beard and black up and was then taken round this ship by the captain. Questions are asked for hands up, please.
I wish she got things like that in her novels.
But... Fred, who might this be?
Well, in a way, I'd be very flattered because I would certainly like to have written a very good novel. I don't think I ever have. And in a way, I think it's maybe it's slightly fraudulent what my pretensions to be a novelist. Perhaps I really am an essayist who uses the novelistic form, but who enjoys it very much.
So, Fred, who do you think that could be?
Well, I think my literate colleague here has got it right, actually. It's E.M. Forster.
Not a bad thought, but not a correct thought.
Sorry about that. Wasn't Frankie Lane, was it?
wasn't Frankie Lane. He was also a bit of a mystic.
Alistair Crowley?
Not Aldous Huxley.
Aldous Huxley. It is Aldous Huxley.
Good.
Well done.
That must have been rather late in his life, that interview, because he seemed to have an American accent to me. I mean, he went off to California and lived in some sort of commune, didn't he? A bit like the Bagwash and all that lot. It was something mystical outfit in the Orange Valley or something.
It was a Hollywood screenwriter.
Well, I know, but he came over all mystic and lived with a lot of gurus and must have acquired it, because he used to be an Eton schoolmaster, he wouldn't have.
I do know that when Aldous Huxley took on American citizenship, he started arguing with a judge who was administering the oath, saying, do you believe in God? He said, well, no, I don't, actually. And he got very sticky water.
Okay, let's move on to our next round. We now look at those who've become more famous under a pseudonym than they ever did under the names they were born with. Nicknames, nom de plumes, stage names, all may feature in our next round entitled Also Known As. Francis, how did Emily Charlotte Le Breton turn a king's head? Emily Charlotte Le Breton.
Yikes. I'm looking at Miles here, but I can't see him. He's hiding his head in his hands.
Is it, it's going to be one of these madams, isn't it?
It will be someone like, Pompadour or... Yes, one of those mistresses of... wives of Louis XIV.
You're getting warm or even saucy.
It could be... Well, perhaps it's Madame Pompadour.
The king in question was the future Edward VII.
Oh, right. Well, we'll scrap
and
that then.
She was a bit old by then. Not much of a mistress.
Well, Edward VII, that doesn't narrow it down much. He had an affair with my great-great-aunt, for heaven's sake.
Do you want to tell us more?
She was called Lily Langtry.
Good heavens.
Yes! That's
what?
The answer.
She was a Jersey Lily.
Sort of by marriage, because she took up with a man called Abington Baird, the squire, as he was known, a racing man. He and Edward VII turned up at the same time one day and had a little punch-up over it. And poor old Abington Baird then died in a barroom brawl in New Orleans, aged about 35, having spent £1 million, which is why his descendants have to go out to work for a living.
this is where the debauchery first started for you, Francis, is it?
Yes, it was, rather, yes.
So is that a Jersey name, then?
It was. It was Emily Charlotte Le Breton, was better known as the actress Lily Langtry. Born in the Channel Islands, she was also known, as you said, Miles, as Jersey Lily, and caused quite a stir when she arrived in London. She was considered to be one of the most beautiful women of her day, the famously flawless complexion and deep violet eyes, a bit like Francis, features which no doubt appealed to the then Prince of Wales, who took her as one of his many mistresses.
It's not often you get a man come on a programme and learn something about his great aunt, which he didn't know before.
Let's turn to you now, Miles. This is a doddle, this one. You'll have no problem with
it. Never say that,
It's a doddle. How did Tatanka Iyotake take a seat in history? And just to help you out, in case you're a bit confused by the name, he was also known as Tatanka Yotanka.
A seat in history?
Seat is a clue.
We know.
Over there they know.
We know.
Tatanka. It sounds very South Seas. It's not one of your uncles, is it?
I think it's one of the Japanese weens, probably.
The only reason someone like that would change his name to become a sportsman or a...
No.
I
think I'm going to have to offer this to the other team who
They're
are
welcome.
Looking bright-eyed.
Yes, I know. The arrogance of knowledge. Sitting Bull.
Absolutely right.
Yeah. He was chief medicine man of Yogalala Sioux, now known as the Lakota. How about that for useless information?
Right, Tatanka Yotanka was the North American Indian name, or Native American name, if you prefer, of Sitting Bull. It was he who led the Sioux against Custer at Little Bighorn. Pursued by American forces, he took refuge in Canada before being allowed to return, whereon he toured in Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West show. Polly, how did Richard Wayne Penniman make a small name for himself? Richard Wayne Penniman, a small name for himself.
A small name? Ah, small name. Richard Wayne Penniman.
You've got to do the actions as well.
You've got to do the actions. You've got to do the jumping up and down and the shouting a lot and the dancing around and all of that. This is Little Richard.
Yes! Fred, your real question now. Who, candidly, was François-Marie Arouet? François-Marie Arouet.
Who's the one who wrote Candide?
Voltaire.
Is it Voltaire?
Yes, it is Voltaire. François-Marie Arouet was Voltaire, best known as the author of Candide, of course. Voltaire lived from 1694 to 1778. He was twice imprisoned in the Bastille for writing libelous political verse, but was forgiven by the powers that be in 1791 when his remains were transferred to the Pantheon in Paris. He must have felt a lot better about that. Now, before we move on, let's have a quick look at the scores. Francis and Miles have 10, and Fred and Polly have 6. Our next round is called Curriculum Vitae. I'll read out a series of perhaps less well-known facts about a certain person from history. Our panelists' job is to identify who it is. The sooner they get it right, the more points I'll award, up to a maximum of 4. So do please feel free to interrupt. Francis, born in 106 BC, he first distinguished himself in Rome by prosecuting the corrupt governor Verres. His first names were Marcus Tullius.
Cicero.
Well done. Yes, you're right. Miles, your first clue. Born in New York in 1916, he was hailed as a child prodigy. He moved to London in 1959.
Sounds like Larry Adler.
No, but keep thinking.
I didn't say it was. I said it sounded like him.
He became a British subject in 1985.
Oh, is it the other musician? Yehudi. Yehudi.
It is!
Oh, God.
Violinist and conductor Yehudi Menuhin, whose virtuosity is matched only by his versatility. He's appeared in concert both with jazz great Stephan Grappelli and sitarist Ravi Shankar. Polly, born on the 12th of March 1949, he attended Swanage Grammar School and Christ's College, Cambridge. He was called to the bar in 1972 and contested the seat of West Bromwich East in the 1974 general election. He was voted BBC Radio Personality of the Year in 1995.
Robin Day. No, of course not. You said 49. No, of course not. BBC Personality of the Year.
In 1995, after his political career had come to a certain amount of grief.
Where was he then? I thought he was older. David Meller.
David Meller is right. Oh. You'd have got it on the final clue, which is he is most famous for elevating the Ministry of National Heritage to the status of Ministry of Fun and Games.
Well, I think he's famous for a football kit and a number of other things too.
Indeed. It's David Meller who incidentally won that radio award for his role as presenter of the soccer phone in 606.
Dangerously close to the number of the beast, isn't it?
During his colourful tenure at National Heritage, Meller was famously involved with Antonio de Sancha, but he also found himself in hot water after accepting a holiday from someone with alleged links to the PLO. I wonder if any of you can remember her name.
Mona Bowen.
Correct. Well done. Fred, born in 1848, he was by profession a doctor. However, he became much more famous in another field in which he excelled along with two brothers.
1848, not Darwin.
No, the main gates at the headquarters of his sport are named...
W.G. Grace.
Well done. It is, of course, W.G. Grace, the giant of Victorian cricket. By far the best cricketer of his generation, Grace was the first player ever to score a triple century and amassed over 50,000 runs in a 43-year career. Our next round is based on a single profession as seen through the eyes of some of its professionals. This week, we're concentrating on film directing. Miles, have a listen to this and try to identify the speaker for us.
Well, I don't think it was lack of success. Three of my marriages were eminently successful. There was only one, and she'll know if she hears this program, which wife I'm referring to.
Miles, who do you think is this serial marrier?
How many marriages is it?
Three he was talking about. No, four he was talking about.
It's one of these doddle questions. I don't know, and I don't
You
think...
might say that he was a man who really would have liked to be king.
Oh. And was his surname Vidor?
Nope.
King of King? No. This is not the man who directed The Quiet American, John Huston.
It is. Well done. It was John Huston, the director of classics such as The Maltese Falcon, The African Queen, and The Man Who Would Be King. Listen to this, Polly, and tell me who is describing the art of film directing. Like being pecked to death by 1,000 pigeons. Everybody's got questions. You get out of the car in the morning, all you want is a bacon sandwich, and there they are. What do you want me to do about this? How are we going to do that? Even when I'd go to the loo, they'd be banging on the door.
Well, pecked to death makes it sound like Hitchcock, but not sure that it really is.
It's somebody you know far better as an actor, current actor, who has done a certain amount of directing and clearly not enjoyed it very much, particularly not when he's sitting on the loo.
Mr. Lou is very modern, it's true. Could it be Kenneth Branagh?
You're in the right sort of neck of the woods, but think bike and sandwich.
Bike and sandwich? Not Bob Hoskins.
Yes, Bob Hoskins. Well
done. What is he? Does he work for the Danish Bacon Board or something? No?
It is Bob Hoskins, detailing the delights of direction. After that, he added, I might direct again, but I ain't giving up my day job. Fred, I'm going to read you three quotes from different people about the same director. All you have to do is identify who it is. First quote. If things get tense, he'd stop production for 5 minutes and say, please remember, we're supposed to be enjoying ourselves. Second quote. Couldn't have been a nicer fellow. I whistled coming to work on his films. Third quote, and this one's by the man himself. Blondes are the best victims. They're like virgin snow which shows up the bloody footprints.
Well, I suppose that I'll have to go first for Hitchcock.
You're right.
Is he?
He's right again. The subject of those views was Sir Alfred Hitchcock. Even though he had a reputation for treating actors badly, the first two quotes from Anthony Perkins and Cary Grant, respectively, showed that he couldn't have been all that bad.
Not many quotes from blondes in there, though.
They might possibly have been offended. Famous people are never happier than when talking about themselves. In our next round, we'll discover just what a deluded, insightful, or downright odd lot they are. As in each case, I ask our panellists to tell me who had the following to say about him or herself. Francis, they call me a twister, but I don't do the twist.
Mine boggles.
Well, let me give you a clue, because it's quite difficult.
Yes, it is, because it's clearly not Chubby Checker.
No. Those words were spoken in 1963... And the politician in question perhaps had the most twisting of his life still to do.
Oh, yes. Would he be called Harold Macmillan?
That would be what he's called. Well done. They were apparently the words of Harold Macmillan.
I'm surprised he'd even heard of the twist by 1963, Harold Macmillan. Remember back in the 1980s when he was still alive, he used to turn up once a year and give an interview to Robin Day saying that he thought his country might yet call on him to go back to Downing Street and be Prime Minister. He said, these young people of today with their jitterbugging. So it's amazing. In the early 60s, he heard about that.
Well, he was obviously more up to date than you thought, Francis, because that's what he said when being asked to dance at a function at the height of the Profumo scandal, who was, of course, the war minister you were talking about. Miles, who might have said the following with a clear self-deprecatory touch? If the fence is strong enough, I'll sit on it.
I think
not many people talk about themselves as fences. Francis is tugging at my
Don't believe it. Well, look, Francis, you're always right. He says it might be Cyril Smith.
Yes, he's right.
My God.
Those were the words of the Pride of Rochdale, Sir Cyril Smith. He was the town's Liberal MP from 1972 to 1992, before which he'd been mayor in 1966. Nationally, his highest office was a spell as Liberal chief whip in the mid-1970s, and all this from very humble beginnings. Until the age of 30, Sir Cyril was a newsagent. Polly, who said this about himself? I am not, and never have been, a man of the right. My position was on the left and is now in the centre of politics. It's a highly misleading quote.
Misleading? Misleading to the right or misleading to the left? Would it be someone like Oswald Mosley?
It is Oswald Mosley.
The one thing he never was of the centre.
Well, he obviously would disagree with you if he were here. Those were the words of Oswald Mosley, British fascist leader, subject of a Channel 4 drama series earlier this year, and well-known centre-left moderate. Fred, I am a lone monk walking the world with a leaky umbrella. Any ideas, Fred?
A lone monk.
I am a lone monk walking the world with a leaky umbrella.
A lone monk. Not Basil Hume.
No. I thought of Keith Joseph, but it's not him either.
Oh, yeah, he was the tortured monk, though, wasn't he?
Not Rasputin, I don't think. He had an
umbrella. But we're getting further and further away from Britain, which is a good idea.
Ah, alone. Was he Indian?
No.
Alone. Was that a lot of people, then?
But India's a very large country, and this man was associated with a very large country. He said those words in 1971. He died 5 years later.
Mao Zedong.
Correct, Francis. Mao was born in 1893, the son of a peasant farmer. It was during his time as a library assistant that he encountered the works of Karl Marx and began his own long march to becoming first chairman of the People's Republic of China.
He's back in favour, though, these days. Now, they've got this strange communist capitalist system in China. They think he's rather good news because they say he pioneered this. And I was there a while ago, and you go to the Mao Mausoleum, and they have communism meets capitalism action, because you go through to see the dead man's body embalmed, which looks horribly like Robert Maxwell. And all these guards, these red guards, say you must show utmost respect. This is a very serious place. And the moment you get past the body, you're into the gift shop, and they've got Chairman Mao cigarettes, pop-up toasters, the whole lot. And all very expensive.
While many famous people spend a lifetime doing famous things, others enter the history books on the strength of an isolated event or deed. In our final round, I ask our teams if they can remember why certain people became famous, if only for Andy Warhol's proverbial 15 minutes. Francis first, why were the blades out for Tonya Harding?
Because she had a row with a woman called Nancy Kerrigan, a fellow American ice skater. And it was the class war by other means, wasn't it? Because one was this stuck-up little rich girl, and the other was a woman who pulled herself up from the wrong side of the tracks. Should have been a country and western singer by normal logic, but somehow became an ice skater and tried to disable her. Was accused, at any rate, of injuring her leg or trying to... Well, it was her lover, in fact, I think, or her husband, who was accused of wielding an iron bar to try and injure this opponent. And they then had to skate against each other at the Winter Olympics.
And who won?
Almost embarrassing. Well, the little goody-goody, of course.
Excellent. That's a textbook answer. Well done. Miles, how did Lance Ito court publicity across the pond?
Lance?
Ito. It's written I-T-O, but pronounced Ito.
Ito is a Japanese name.
This is correct.
Francis has nudged me, I have to say. I didn't follow the O.J. Simpson trial at all.
Now you wish you had.
No, I don't. he was a judge, wasn't he?
He was the judge. Well done. He was the judge in the O.J. Simpson trial. He was criticised at the time as a shameless self-publicist. Don't see what's wrong with that. Ito's since reported to have returned to obscurity, or more likely he's waiting to pick up the money from his blockbuster memoirs. Polly, how did Matthias Rust land himself in hot water and the history books?
Oh, this was a wonderful story. This was the very young man, I think he was, who flew in the microlite in some very, very small plane and landed in the middle of Red Square.
That's correct.
I don't remember why. Was he delivering Bibles or tracts or something of that kind? Was there, or was it just for fun?
I think he was just delivering himself into imprisonment. He did land in Red Square in May 1987, and the embarrassment to the Russians at having their airspace penetrated led to the immediate dismissal of the defence minister. Rust, meanwhile, despite protesting that he'd done it to promote world peace, he may have had some Bibles, I don't know, was sentenced to 4 years imprisonment before being released by the Gorbachev regime as a humanitarian gesture. Fred, on what did Carl Andre build his fame?
Oh, this is the bricklayer, the guy who sort of turned up at the Tate Gallery with like four pallet loads of bricks. They should have gone to the place down the road where they were building a garage. And someone went, put them over there, George, they'll pick them up later. And like the curator of the Tate came in and went, God, blimey, it's instant art, he said. And they went, leave them there. And of course, what happened afterwards was we found out the curator of the Tate did have that garage built.
Very good. What Fred meant to say was that, oh, Carl Andre is an important minimalist artist, but he didn't quite get there. But I think we'll give him the points anyway. Well done, Fred. The Tate bought a piece of his work consisting of 120 bricks. Nowadays, it's one of the Tate's most popular attractions. Although, of course, it's still the case that no one has the faintest idea what it's meant to be about. And the end of that round brings us to the end of the show. And a glance at the scores tells me that Francis and Miles have 29 points, Fred and Polly have 27 points. So our winners this week are Francis and Miles. Well done to the winners. Bad luck to the losers. We'll have another chance to do it again. That just leaves me to thank our panellists, Francis Wheen, Miles Kington, Polly Toynbee, and Fred Housegrove.